This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Here's a question. Can you imagine getting advice on how to draw cartoons from an organization called the American Freedom Defense Initiative? Furthermore, would you consider a contest for the best cartoon depicting the Prophet Muhammad with a $10,000 reward, an exercise in free speech, or a celebration of hate speech? Or, as this woman basically says, something that is as American as apple pie.
Well, it's dangerous because increasingly we're abridging our freedoms so as not to offend savages. The very idea that if something offends me or I'm insulted by something, I'll kill you, and that way I can get my way. And somehow this is okay with members of the elite media and academia is outrageous.
That's Pamela Geller, the executive director of the American Freedom Defense Initiative, speaking on CNN earlier today. In Garland, Texas, less than 20 miles from Dallas, two gunmen were killed Sunday night, you've probably heard, after opening fire at an event hosted by Geller, who openly declares that offended Muslims are savages. Not much is known about the assailants, who were able to shoot and injure a security guard before they were shot and killed by police officers who were on the scene at the Curtis Colwell Center, which is normally a venue for public school students. That's where was held a, quote, Muhammad art exhibit and contest. Geert Wilders, a bitterly anti-Islamic Dutch politician, was one of the speakers at the event last night. Clearly, the idea of possible violence at an event like this was not unexpected, and protection was paid for in advance by American Freedom Defense. Here's Garland Police Department Officer Joe Harn speaking at a news conference earlier today.
Two men exited the dark-colored sedan. Both of them had assault rifles, came around the back of the car, and started shooting at the police car. The police officer in that car began returning fire and struck both men, taking them down.
Officer Joe Harn, spokesman for the Garland Police Department. Joining me now with more is Eric Ossen, reporter with KERA in Dallas. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the broad context here. In many ways, this event last night began with an event that took place right after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, where Muslims in the community decided to take some matters into their own hands and hold a discussion session of some kind.
Exactly, and that event was held at that same event center in Garland, and it was mostly a peaceful event, aside from a few protesters outside. The idea was to help Muslims help navigate this changing world and how to better talk about what they stand for. And it was designed as more of an informative session. So this event last night in Garland, featuring the American Freedom Defense Initiative, Pamela Geller, the executive director of that event, had heard about this event in January and decided to specifically hold her event in Garland last night. And keep in mind, her group is a New York-based group.
And the Muslims who were at the community event months ago were local, right?
Exactly.
All right. So was there the same kind of security at the local event as there was for this last night?
There was security at both events, but security was definitely heightened yesterday. It was planned weeks, if not months, in advance. The AFDI group, American Freedom Defense Initiative, had to pay about $50,000 on security. So there were several layers of security, including security inside the building. Pamela Geller, that director, was pictured with armed guards inside. But there were also police officers outside the perimeter of the building. And when those two men, you know, in the car, the shooters, tried to approach the perimeter, there was a school security officer who was unarmed, along with a Garland City police officer who was armed, who stopped them. And the two shooters got out of the car, and the police officer just started shooting, and both were killed.
I mean, this is a very difficult issue because, as in the Charlie Hebdo case, even though it was in France, I mean, here in the United States, what they did at the Garland Community Center is completely legal. It's free speech, protected free speech. But in any sense, in the lead up to this, do you have an impression that perhaps they were looking for a confrontation of some kind? Obviously not shooters, but something?
Pamela Geller would say that that they weren't trying to egg on people. That's the impression I'm getting from what she's been telling other media outlets, that her group's thoughts might be provocative, but that they have a right to express those viewpoints. She said this morning on CNN that she's not concerned with Muslims, especially peaceful Muslims, but she says she's concerned with those who support Sharia law. And her group was awarding $10,000 last night to the best cartoon that depicts Muhammad the Prophet, and that this is simply a way for people to express their viewpoints. And she keeps on going back to First Amendment and the rights that her group has to speak their minds freely. Now, keep in mind that the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks a lot of groups, many of them extreme, lists her group, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, as an, quote, active anti-Muslim group. Now, of course, she would not agree with that. But clearly, there is a lot of controversy surrounding this group, and there's a lot of Twitter traffic leading up to the event over the past few weeks, with people on all sides of the issue talking about it, and some encouraging violence to take place at this event last night, although local Muslim and Islam groups were not at the center, were not protesting, and in fact, didn't want to give Pamela Geller and her group any more publicity.
Well, she certainly raised tension in the community. Eric Austin, reporter with KERA in Dallas. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
As we begin the week, an aggressive response to the police brutality charges by prosecutors in Baltimore has seemed to stem the tide of street unrest.
I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man.
Charges ranging from second-degree murder to assault for the six accused officers implicated in the death of Freddie Gray sent the message last Friday from state's attorney Marilyn Mosby that the state and city mean business. A citywide curfew was lifted yesterday. Joining me now is Alan Weingrad. He's the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York. He prosecuted police officers for assaulting a Haitian man in the famous Abner Louima case here in New York City in 1997. Two officers were convicted of their crimes in that case. Both received prison sentences. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the Louima case was very challenging. It was also very outrageous in the sense of evidence and the kinds of brutality that was the case. Is it as clear-cut here in Baltimore, do you think?
Well, I mean, the charges would suggest that it is outrageous. I mean, a man who's arrested apparently for no good reason ends up with a broken spine within an hour and dead within a week. So something wrong happened here, and the question is what, and can the prosecutor prove it?
Prosecutors typically don't bring charges in as aggressive a manner as this without intending to win the case. So do you think they clearly have the goods here?
Time will tell. I mean, the prosecutor said she did a thorough independent investigation, interviewed many witnesses, viewed videotape, obviously had the medical examiner's report. I think she should be commended for doing a thorough and expeditious investigation. That's the easy part. The hard part is proving it in court.
Now, in terms of the law, when the fatal injury occurred is sort of immaterial. As long as he was in police custody and they failed to help him or any of that, could lead to the similar charges.
Right. And I think the key part is going to be whether the prosecutor can prove how he was hurt fatally.
And does a particular officer have to have delivered a fatal blow for it to be second-degree murder?
No. The charge of second-degree murder against the driver is based on a callous indifference to Mr. Gray's life. So they don't even have to prove that he touched him. They have to prove that he acted so recklessly that he caused his death really without caring whether he was going to live or whether he was going to die.
Where does the process go from here? You've seen a very high-profile and aggressive statement from Mosby. The wheels of justice turn not necessarily at the speed of politicians.
Right. So it's going to be many months before this case goes to a trial, and I think we're going to see some efforts by the defense to try to level the playing field. Sounds like they're going to make a motion to recuse this prosecutor on the grounds of her conflicts, and I think she'll get through that. More interesting might be an effort to change the venue of this case so that it's not tried in Baltimore because of all the public attention and the demonstrations and such. We can expect they'll argue that they can't get a fair trial there.
Of course, in that case, then you have the Simi Valley issue with the Rodney King case where the change of venue there produced an acquittal and the huge unrest that took place in Los Angeles in that case.
Right. In the Rodney King case, in the Amadou Diallo case in New York, which was moved out of New York City to Albany, that also resulted in acquittals of all the officers. So there is some precedent for this.
The bringing of these charges by Marilyn Mosby, does it bypass the grand jury in as we saw in the Ferguson case?
Well, she did initially, but ultimately we would expect that a grand jury will return an indictment here, and that's what will cause the case to go to trial.
So the indictment is more of a formality the way this is working out?
More or less, I think that's right. I mean, she wanted to move quickly and filing her own charges, which under the law she's permitted to do, to bring the defendants into the system and get them in custody. That she was able to do that even before the police investigation was over.
So this sends the message that the belaboring of it down in Ferguson was really the result of prosecutors delaying things, that really every prosecutor has this power to move swiftly past the indictment stage.
Right. But that's the easy part. It's pretty easy for a prosecutor to file charges based on probable cause that crimes were committed, which is a low standard. What she's got to do to win this case in court is prove those charges beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the highest standard that we have under the law.
How much does politics intervene in the justice system in a case like this and make it difficult to try a case like this?
You know, one hopes that it doesn't. One hopes that the prosecutor conscientiously does their job, collects the evidence, examines the law, and proves their case in court. And you have to hope that that process isn't influenced by understandable efforts to bring about community calm and avoid unrest or worse.
Department of Justice is looking into patterns of misconduct in Baltimore as all of this transpired. Any sense that that becomes a basis of evidence in this case at all?
Not unless it relates to this particular case. I think this case will go to trial and stand or fall on the merits of this particular episode and not any prior patterns of misconduct, unless one of the officers was involved in some prior instances, in which case the jury might hear that evidence at the trial.
And in many ways, Mosby has set herself up for being on trial. She's got to deliver a conviction here, and certainly the police department in Baltimore is on trial.
Certainly the former is true. I mean, she's definitely now taken hold of this case and in a very aggressive and prominent and public way, taken it upon herself to deliver convictions in this case. Time will tell whether she can deliver on that promise.
And it's up to others to judge the police department in Baltimore.
I think that's right, the Justice Department or others, but that's not really the function of this particular case.
Alan Weingrad is the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York. He prosecuted officers for assaulting the Haitian man Abner Louima in that famous case in 1997 in New York City. Two officers were convicted of their crimes and both received prison sentences. Alan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Aggressive prosecutions may deal with police practices after the fact, but what of efforts to reform police departments to prevent street tension, racial suspicion, and the kind of brutality that has led to the latest unrest in Baltimore? Over the past decades, the U.S. Department of Justice has intervened in Cleveland, New Orleans, Los Angeles, Miami, and other places. DOJ has investigated the police department in Ferguson, Missouri, and was already investigating police misconduct in Baltimore when Freddie Gray's death occurred. The Marshall Project, which covers the criminal justice system in depth, has found that DOJ's involvement very often is successful in implementing some reforms in the early going, but much less effective in making those reforms stick. And in some notable cases, things haven't changed much at all. Simone Weichselbaum is a staff writer with the Marshall Project, and she and her team spent 5 months looking into the impact of Justice Department reforms.
The reason why we decided to do this story here at the Marshall Project is after a police-involved shooting that gets a lot of press attention, the feds are usually asked to come in by a city mayor or the public, and sometimes they do. And then we think, oh, problem solved. The feds will take care of it. So what we wanted to do is actually look back, going back into the mid-90s when these investigations first begun, and see what were the outlooks like? Did it actually work?
And so the people of Ferguson, who just got this report talking about patterns of racism within their own police department, very damning report, assumptions on the part of the people on the streets of Ferguson that, okay, maybe something will be done now. If you were to look at the situation in Los Angeles and Cleveland and the places you looked at, what should the people of Ferguson feel? That much will change, or that actually the report tends to be kind of the end of it?
Well, the report is actually the beginning of it, but what's needed in these situations is local buy-in. So with the LAPD, we had the feds were there for more than a decade almost, right, through most of Bill Bratton's tenure, and Charlie Beck took it over. And you had the police commissioner say, yes, we have a problem and we're going to address it. Cleveland, what was really interesting to us was actually the feds were in there in the early aughts, which again, when Eric Holder announced his findings report in late December, that wasn't really announced at the press conference. So it was really shocking to me to see, wait a minute, the feds were already in Cleveland. They had said, hey, police officers, you guys have a problem here of firing upon fleeing vehicles. And what brought them in the first place in 2012, I believe, was again, officers firing at a car. It was 137 bullets that were fired, got a lot of press attention. The mayor had asked the feds to come back, and here we are again. So with Ferguson, what will be interesting is with the new leadership, they had elections there recently, will the local city officials actually say, yes, we're going to follow the federal reforms? If there's an election in 4 years or another 8 years, will those set of new local officials also buy into the local reforms? So that's very important. It's not just the feds' role here. You have to have a partnership between local and the federal government.
Does there need to be a mechanism to ensure buy-in, to monitor buy-in, and to make sure that the community is dealing with this seriously?
Well, in a way, there is a mechanism. It's called the federal monitor. So in many of these agreements, there's something called a consent decree, where both local officials and the federal government basically sign a bunch of paperwork to say, yes, we are going to follow this reform plan. But what happens is we looked at, this wasn't in this story, but the first story we had done on this situation in Cincinnati, there was something called a memorandum of agreement that was signed by both local officials and the feds. We sort of looked at the story analytically and saw that there were sort of mixed results. You do have local buy-in still in place years later, but you still have issues with them shooting folks who are mentally ill. You still have use of force issues and people of color. So there is a mechanism in place with the federal monitor. But again, 5 years goes by, 10 years goes by. How do we know these things are going to still stay in place? The feds can't stay there forever.
Is the Marshall Project interested in the possibility that, maybe these videos themselves, which are a huge new factor really over the last couple of years in the sense that everyone's got a camera in their hands. I mean, the Rodney King video, of course, is a while ago now. But are the videos themselves and the idea that police now have an expectation that they're going to be caught if something happens, a form of accountability that perhaps the federal government can design to take advantage of on some level?
Well, the federal government in many of these reform plans does ask for body cameras or dashboard cameras, but we sort of have two parallel use of cameras here. We have the public walking by an incident, which we saw with the Walter Scott case, and recording it. Mm-hmm. And then you have the instance of the actual police officer keeping his camera on at all times. So by chance, if you have a member of the public walking by a situation and recording it, great. That is great evidence to support a situation where the officer said something else had occurred. But many instances, what we have to rely on are body cameras or dashboard cameras. And that gets to a whole other issue of disclosure when the police department says they will or will not share that information. And also, if the body cameras even work, that's also another issue. That's one thing I did learn while reporting the story, that there's no uniform rules for police departments out there. It's all willy-nilly. And it will take a lot of work with the federal government and the police lobbyist groups to come up with a plan, if they ever do, of saying, hey, these are some concrete rules we need and all police departments should follow these rules, whether it's body cameras, whether it's use of force policies.
Simone Weichselbaum is staff writer with the Marshall Project. Thanks so much.
No problem.
What do you think of the reform track record in police departments in your community? Gerald Richards from Lyle, Washington. I think most cops do a pretty good job in tough circumstances. I think in recent decades, we citizens have not been performing adequately our responsibility to police the police, which includes disciplining and or getting rid of the thugs. Without this oversight, cops naturally fall back into the ancient pattern of smashing the poor and protecting the property of the rich without much attention to due process. Charles writes, does the fact that charges have been referred for prosecution now mean that the riots can stop? What sort of moral world do people reside in where they can't be satisfied with a fair trial? What sort of moral code dictates that if they aren't found guilty, there'll be more riots? Baltimore also has the lesson of the 1968 riots to work off of, wherein blacks burning and looting of mostly their own neighborhoods was shown to have been productive of mostly nothing in terms of neighborhood improvement or social advancement. And Liam J. Halley writes on Facebook, anyone believing this rioting and destruction has to do with anything more than testosterone and groupthink is kidding themselves. Join the conversation. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. tickets with you on your commute home from work. And again, find it anywhere you get your podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing basic tools for individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, and more. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story, starring Carey Mulligan, Matthias Schoenaert, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge, in select theaters now. And Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org. Medical doctor turned pundit Ben Carson is a fixture on conservative cable TV criticizing President Obama. Former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina has turned pundit and is a fixture on business cable channels criticizing President Obama. Now, both have turned their attention to criticizing the Democratic frontrunner in the race for the White House, Hillary Clinton. Both have announced they are running for president. Joining me now is Jim Rittenberg, chief political correspondent for The New York Times Magazine. Jim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So Ben is the only black candidate running on the GOP side. Carly Fiorina is the only woman running on the GOP side. What would we call these two candidates, the entourage candidates, a particular wing of the Republican Party?
You know, I would say that they're from two different categories. It's at this point there could be so many candidates in the Republican field that they're up to four different categories. I would say that Ben Carson is – they're both definitely long shots. I would say that Carly Fiorina is definitely more business wing, and Ben Carson, Dr. Ben Carson, is has a growing – we'll see how much it grows – Tea Party following and a nice evangelical following as well.
So a Ron Paul kind of cult following for Ben Carson, and Carly Fiorina doesn't have the money to self-finance her campaign like Mitt Romney did, does she?
No, but, you know, we'll see when she gets in. One would think that she would have great access to capital given her business background, but there's so much competition at the top of the field for the big money donors that she is going to struggle. Maybe she'll get a lot of female donations, but we'll have to see. I don't feel the groundswell for Carly Fiorina that I feel for that I see it with Ben Carson.
Is there a coattails effect to just sort of being in the group of candidates on the GOP side? Mike Huckabee has made a career out of running for president, and it appears he's going to do it again.
He has made a career of it. Huckabee actually will be, by the way, the biggest threat to Ben Carson or vice versa. Ben Carson, though, however, doesn't need to run for president to make money. He's already so huge on the speaking circuit. He's a best-selling author. He's really kind of an extraordinary figure in this field. Again, perhaps a marginal one, but he doesn't need this the way maybe Huckabee did to turn himself into a TV star or build some different kind of career.
Do you think Ben Carson has the ability to legitimately pull an African-American constituency for the GOP on any level?
I don't know. Good question. There was a very good story in the Washington Post over the weekend that showed that Ben Carson was a folk hero in the black community because he has a Horatio Alger kind of story where he came out from extreme poverty, becomes really one of the top neurosurgeons in the country, if not the world, for real, not hyperbole. Yet he's gone after President Obama with so much vigor and at times with such kind of extreme rhetoric that he's turned off many potential black supporters.
And as for Fiorina, does she attract, candidates who are mainstream for being a possible running mate in some level, or can she, make it on her own? Is her staying power in the GOP race a sign that she might be there at the end as somebody's VP candidate?
again, as a VP candidate, I'm not sure I see it because and we never, some of the thinking that goes into VP candidates and selections, it's a little bit of witchcraft. I don't know how much of it's true, but the nominees like to pick someone who presumably is going to bring a big following. It's something that candidate doesn't have. So for Carly Fiorina to become a real viable, even VP choice, she's going to have to build a real movement. She hasn't done anything like that yet, but it is early. So, you know, the great thing about politics is hopefully it's full of surprises. So maybe she'll surprise us. But she, to me, I just don't see it right now.
Sort of new faces. Certainly Ben Carson is a new face in the presidential run. We'll see if they add anything to the discourse, bring a different kind of message, because the bigger the field, the more entertaining the debates, that's for sure. And Jim Rutenberg, chief political correspondent for The New York Times Magazine, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
To hear my full sit-down interview with Ben Carson that I did some months ago, you can visit us at thetakeaway.org. Before China's emergence as the 21st century powerhouse in politics and economic clout, and all the world was coming to China's doorstep, China for many decades was a place that millions of people preferred to leave behind or escape in fear of their lives. A culture of Chinatowns, especially in America, became a proud, prosperous, and isolated collection of communities in cities where Asian Americans were looked on with suspicion and faced discrimination that continues in some places to this day. There were Chinese-American newspapers in Mandarin and Cantonese and other languages. A lively music scene accompanied the spirited celebration of traditional holidays, mostly out of sight of mainstream America. And there were sports. It looks like volleyball. It's played in parking lots. It is very, very serious.
You kind of explain it as organized jungle ball.
I mean, you got 9 people on the court as opposed to 6.
To call other volleyball sissy ball.
I played in park lots before and I got rocks in my skin and my knees.
When we talk about it to our white friends or other like volleyball players, they all want to play, but they're not allowed to play.
This is our World Series. This is our Super Bowl.
It's called Nine Man, and it continues to be played in Chinatowns across North America as a gritty athletic tradition born from segregation, but now enjoyed with pride. A new film called Nine Man looks at this organized jungle ball, the sport, its history, and some of its players. It premieres on the public television World Channel series America Reframed tomorrow. Ursula Liang is the film's director, producer, and cinematographer. She joins us in the studio here in New York. And Bobby Goon, dentist by day, is the coach of the Boston Knights. He's up at our partner station WGBH in Boston. Bobby, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to you, Ursula.
Thank you.
So, Bobby, coach of the Boston Knights, how are the Knights doing?
We're doing all right. We're perennial contenders right now. We haven't gotten over the hump. We're chasing after some prestigious, powerful team. And hopefully someday we'll get up there at the upper echelons.
How many cities, and if you can name them, please do, have nine-man teams?
Well, the traditional cities are Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Toronto, and Montreal up in Canada. That forms the circuit. And also, L.A. has joined the circuit again. And we have teams coming from other Chinatowns now. We have representatives from Houston, from Philadelphia, at times Chicago.
So it's growing. Ursula, how do you play nine-man? Can you explain it?
That's a good question for me. I'm not allowed to play nine-man. I'm a woman, so I've never actually played. The rule book state that it's a game for men, and the game looks like volleyball on the surface. If you walked by it, you might mistake it for volleyball, but don't mistake it because it's completely another game. There's a lot of swagger, a lot of attitude. There's a lot of added chaos and creativity.
Had you heard of Nine Man as you were growing up?
No, I hadn't. I grew up in the suburbs of Boston playing sort of standard volleyball and wasn't very connected to the Chinatown community. So I didn't learn about Nine Man until my 20s when I sort of started dipping into the Chinatown culture.
How long has this been going on, Bobby?
Before I was born. When I grew up in Boston's Chinatown, one of the first joyful experiences of seeing our Chinese men playing any type of sport was volleyball in the streets of the parking lots in Chinatown. I think it goes back to the 30s, if not earlier.
Did you always know it as nine man?
I only knew it as volleyball. I never knew there was any other type of volleyball until we got to high school.
So, name some moves. What are the moves? I mean, I imagine there's Chinese names for all the stuff that you do in this game.
There are a number of specific distinctions from six-person volleyball. One is that you don't rotate around the court. The other is that there are ways in which you can gain an additional hit. So the same person can hit the ball twice in a row by passing the ball into the net to themselves and then hitting it again.
Did you say that you can bounce it off the net to yourself?
Yes, you can.
That's wild.
So that, volleyball has a rhythm. It's bump, set, spike. And if you're used to that, I played since I was in seventh grade. It becomes very disorienting if you add that additional, offsetting rhythm.
What story does this movie tell about Chinese-American culture?
That's a good question. I mean, we follow a couple teams throughout a nine-man season, which is typically from May to September. There's a big tournament every Labor Day. Teams from all these cities gather in one city, and they sort of fight it out for this major championship. And it's really a tournament of bragging rights and pride and nothing other than a trophy. And they play all summer long to get this trophy. But it's also an exploration of Chinatown and Chinatown's history. Like Bobby said, it's been played organized fashion since the 1930s, but it's been played since before that. And Chinatown at that time was still a very male society. And so you had this sort of bachelor society where men really were faced with a lot of discrimination and had very tough lives, and they needed an emotional and physical escape.
Ursula, I think you in Boston's Chinatown, I think we took you behind some of the streets in Chinatown, and there's these hidden alleys that were part of my growing up, and these were between tenement houses, and I remember the old-timers just stringing it up while they were on their break or before they went to the work in the restaurants.
How does Nine Man reflect and show Chinese-American pride? Who are the stars, and how do you have heroes in this game if it's only played in Chinatown?
Well, one of the major stars in the nine-man circuit is actually an Olympian. His name is Kevin Wong. He's 6'7", and he's really an imposing figure, but really the pride of one of the people are really excited to see every tournament. He played in the Sydney Olympics, and his partner is a beach volleyball player. And his partner at some point during his career was Karch Krai, who was basically the Michael Jordan of beach volleyball. So he became connected to the tournament, I think, when he was after college, and has played for a long time now. And he, he comes in and plays against 8-year-old boys sometimes and 60-year-old men. It's this great intergenerational space where the guys in their 20s and 30s are the most competitive, but it's also a place where people are coming to come together as a community.
And you're pretty good in the day, right, Bobby?
given that there are no real historical written records, I can say anything I want.
Well, and you do. You're a star in this film, and you're very much grabbing for some bragging rights.
Well, Bobby's good at bragging, for sure. Part of the game is the trash talking, and he excels in that, for sure.
There was a PhD in trash talking. I'll be at Harvard right now, I'll tell you.
All right, who's...
It's a defensive mechanism. Ursula said, these Chinese restaurant workers, our father's generation, they really had not much to really hang their hat on. I mean, the crowds, I think part of it's brought up in the New York scenes that Ursula shot, when you have these immigrants smoking cigarettes and just hanging out there. And they rally behind a game, and they're giving comments. They're trash-talking in the crowds. Maybe they're taking bets. Who knows? But that's what you're playing for, that elation.
Bobby Goon is the dentist and star, one of the stars of the film Nine Man. He's coach of the Boston Knights. Ursula Liang is a director, producer, and cinematographer of Nine Man. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today in the Getting Your Priorities Straight department. Let's note that over the weekend, Avengers Age of Ultron received $187.7 million from grateful American movie fans. Boxing fans around the world, probably not so gratefully, gave over about $400 million by some estimates to watch Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao hug and rub sweat on each other for 12 rounds. Tonight, grateful patrons of the Metropolitan Museum of Art will pony up upwards of $12 million at the annual benefit for the museum's costume division, a priceless collection of rich people's old clothes. that has raised more than $145 million in the last 15 years from rich people who want to show off their new clothes at the Met Gala. Meanwhile, the U.S. has donated, any guesses, $10 million to the earthquake victims of Nepal, more than 7,000 dead, millions in need of food, clothes, shelter, waiting for aid, stuck at the damaged airport in Kathmandu. That's all for today. You can ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back to you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.